Okay, well, thanks, Curtis, for inviting me to do this. And speaking as a resident of Pittsburgh, welcome everybody to Pittsburgh. I hope you have a chance to try a Pittsburgh salad, which is lettuce with French fries and steak on top. That way you can say you had a salad for lunch, and it sounds like you were very healthy.
Position the microphone more directly.
Today I want to talk about radiogenic isotopes as applied to soils. And I will give a little bit of history of the technique, but of course, for this audience, I want to focus mostly on the pedogenic applications of radiogenic isotopes. So I'll go a little bit through what radiogenic isotopes are, the techniques we use to measure them, and then I'll give some examples of how they have been applied fairly recently, in the last 25 years or so, to soils and ecosystems, just as kind of a taste of the possibilities. And this smattering of examples will be things that are, you know, most near and dear to me, so they won't be representative by any means. But hopefully they'll give you some flavor of what you can do. First of all, and I'm talking about radiogenic isotopes. Let's see. I do want to contrast with stable isotopes in the sense of the stable isotopes that most of you are probably familiar with, things like oxygen isotopes, hydrogen, carbon, which are very commonly applied to soil systems and with great utility. But with radiogenic, we're not really talking about mass fractionation so much, which is the case with these, where you get actual fractionation of one isotope from another due to mass-dependent processes, which can go on concurrently with soil formation or prior to soil formation in the atmosphere or different parts of the ecosystem. Radiogenic are not things like those. And to illustrate what I mean by radiogenic isotopes, I'll use the strontium isotope system as an example of a radiogenic isotope system, one of many that can be used and applied. So strontium has four stable isotopes, meaning they're not radioactive, they don't decay away, strontium 84, 86, 87, and 88. In addition, though, rubidium 87 decays by beta decay to strontium 87 with a half-life of about 50 billion years. And so what that means is that over time, over very long time scales, geologic time, the isotope strontium 87 will be augmented by the decay of rubidium 87. And the extent to which strontium 87 is augmented will depend very much on the history of that particular rock, primarily the amount of rubidium relative to strontium that's in the rock and how long it's been exposed to that strontium or to that rubidium. So, for example, if we think of a whole rock like a granite, which crystallizes some time in the past. When it crystallized, it was very hot, and so all the minerals that formed were isotopically homogenized in that magma. So it starts at a time zero, and all the minerals in that granite are isotopically identical in terms of their strontium 87 to 86 ratio. We just take the 87 and normalize it to 86, which is not augmented by any other decays. Over time, and we're talking about millions of years, minerals with high rubidium-strontium ratios will evolve high 87-86 ratios. Those with low rubidium-strontium ratios will evolve low ratios, and those in between will evolve ratios in between. So when we measure these things today, if there's been sufficient time, we'll find that each mineral in that rock will have a different strontium-87-86 ratio, a different isotope signature. Oops, okay, that's backwards. And on a larger scale, you can look at it planet-wide. Generally speaking, when we form continental crust from the mantle, the crust will be enriched in rubidium relative to strontium, so that chunk of continental crust will evolve a very high 87-86 ratio, whereas basalt it forms will have a lower 87-86 ratio. So it's through these kinds of processes that what we end up with today is rocks and minerals, which in general have very different strontium isotope compositions from each other. And that's the kind of thing that we try to take advantage of when we apply these things to pedogenic systems, is we have a kind of a built-in fingerprint for different components of our pedogenic system. Now, of course, radiogenic isotopes like strontium have been used for a long time as a geochronology tool, because if you look at that, if you can measure the rubidium-strontium ratio of your rocks or minerals and the present-day isotope composition, you can correct it back to that time when they are all the same, and that's the age of your rock. And so, for example, this is an isochron, which we call, which does just that, of an iron meteorite, silicate inclusions within an iron meteorite, where these workers were dating the time of planetary formation of a planetesimal in the asteroid belt. And so they use it this way. And this was sort of the original use that geologists had for radiogenic isotopes. And of course, strontium is not the only one that's available for use. There's many others. They have different half-lives, different parent and daughter. That is, the parent being the one that decays, the daughter that is augmented. And these all have different chemical properties. So depending on what it is you're trying to do, they may have very different utility for you, and you may be able to apply them in different ways, or sometimes more than one system together. Some of these you're probably familiar with, uranium-lead system, which is probably the best for geologic dating of rocks, but there are many others, too, that we can potentially apply. Now, how do we make these measurements? First of all, here's where we get into a little bit of the history. And really, these kinds of measurements that we need to be useful in geology and pedology were made possible right around 1940, when Alfred Neer developed the modern version of the magnetic sector mass spectrometer. And that's shown here. It's a fairly simple design, where you have your ion source on one end, so you generate ions of the element you're interested in, accelerate it down a flight tube, it hits a magnetic field, and its path is deflected. The deflection of the path will simply, the degree to which the path is deflected depends on the mass of the isotope. Heavy ones are deflected less than light ones. And if you have suitable detectors at the end, you can measure the relative abundance of those isotopes in your sample. So this was his early 60-degree sector instrument. Today, most of them are configured something like this. This is highly idealized, but you have a 90 degrees, so an ion source. So you take something like strontium, which you've separated from your rock, ionize it by heating it up on a filament, accelerate those ions through the magnetic field, and then you get a separation of isotopes based on mass, and we usually now measure them simultaneously and just get the ratio of atoms of each isotope and work that back in. And this is an example of the latest thermal ionization mass spectrometer that uses this technique by Triton, where you can put in multiple samples into this turret here, and it's a breakaway view down the flight tube into the magnet, and then ultimately into these Faraday collectors, and get extremely good data down to the below 10 ppm reproducibility of your isotope ratio, which is what's often required for these kinds of measurements. And there's a new type of instrument, relatively new, that's being used increasingly, which are multi-collector ICP-MS, which take basically the back end of the sector mass spectrometer and put a ICP-MS in the front, so you can introduce solutions into your instrument. Sometimes you can laser ablate samples directly in there and measure isotope ratios on those samples. So there's a lot of development that's been going on in new systems that are being worked out using this technology. Now, whether you do multi-collector ICP-MS or thermal ionization mass spectrometry, it does require clean lab chemistry in order to carry out these measurements, because in many cases we're taking very small sub-ppm, sub-ppb, sometimes parts per trillion level, trace elements, separating them out, from the matrix, whether it's rock or a aqueous fluid, and loading nanogram quantities onto a filament and putting that into the mass spectrometer. So it doesn't take much to contaminate your sample. So for example, University of Pittsburgh in our department, we required that they remove all the chalkboards from the department because chalk has a lot of strontium in it, and we wouldn't be able to teach and go in the lab the same day, and neither would our students if they still had those. So those are the kinds of things you have to worry about. But it's certainly doable. And now, as far as applications to pathogenesis and soils and ecosystems, the utility of radiogenic isotopes is generally not so much to try to date things, because soils evolve, for the most part, on shorter time scales than the rocks that geologists are interested in, although there are some applications to try to date timing of soil genesis. But really, primarily, it's to use these isotopes as tracers for different soil processes. And the idea is simply that you have some component, whether it's a mineral, whether it's water that's entering a soil which contains strontium, or it's a rock in a watershed, which is different from another component in that watershed or in that rock, that they each have different isotopic ratios. And if they mix together in some way or combine into a third phase, it'll take the characteristics of both. And you can use this information to quantify the relative fluxes of two or more different components into your system, as long as you can characterize the end members. So that's the general idea of how we approach these kinds of problems. And in a soil system, of course, there's many different facets you can look at using this, but in applying these things, we see all these as very dynamic fluxes, and so you can focus, for example, on the soil exchange, look sort of at labile cations, and track the movement of cations into and out via vegetation or soil water going in and out, or immobilization of certain things into secondary soil minerals. You can look at weathering that might take place of primary soil minerals to free up cations into the exchange and see how that goes into the mixture and ultimately gets taken up, for example, by vegetation. We can look at the effects of precipitation and try to quantify, for example, nutrients that are applied to a soil system via precipitation versus weathering. So there's many different ways you can look at it, many different points of view you can take in applying this to soils. And we're really just limited by our imagination and ability to measure the end members. So let me just give you a few examples of how these have been applied, just so you get a flavor of it. One of the earliest true applications of radiogenic isotopes to soil systems was by Graustein and Armstrong back in 1983, where they looked at a watershed in New Mexico and tried to use strontium isotopes to quantify dust input and uptake of calcium by vegetation, using strontium as a proxy for calcium because it's geochemically very similar. And what they're able to show is that strontium isotope composition is a useful tracer in their particular system, and that it's applicable wherever the 87:86 ratio of the bedrock is different from that material delivered to the site from remote sources. So the idea is that you can start to apply this in other systems where you have distinct sources. That's something in a particular site you have to determine by on-site measurements. You can't always predict if it's going to work or not. So this was one of the early applications. And then a lot of work was carried out by Aberg and co-workers in looking at nutrient cycling in ecosystems, particularly uptake of calcium and strontium by plants, and trying to quantify the extent, the degree to which soil weathering contributed nutrients versus precipitation or other sources, groundwater sources that may be entering into the system. And in fact, Aberg, in a series of papers, also was able to look at strontium isotopes in tree rings as a time record of how these sources have changed and relate that to acidification of the watershed. So he's very one of the early workers in this field and very creative in his approaches. Then there was a influential paper published in Nature in 1993 where they, in the Hubbard Brook Watershed Experimental Forest in New Hampshire, where Miller, Bloom, and Friedland used strontium isotopes to really help quantify the extent to which different components of the soil were weathering and contributing to the overall cation exchange in the soil. And we're able to use that to project forward the effects of acidification and how it might affect the cation exchange capacity of these forest soils in the future. Another example, this by my co-author in this talk, where strontium isotopes are used, in this case, to quantify the relative contributions of weathering and atmospheric deposition. This is work we did also in collaboration with Curtis, who helped us in the field sites, done a number of studies in New Mexico. And the idea here was that, this is from near Las Cruces, New Mexico, and this is not a great photo of it, but we have these pedogenic calcite horizons developed in the soil. And the idea that Capo and Chadwick wanted to test was, what's the source of the calcium in the calcite? Does it come from in-situ weathering of soil minerals, or is it contributed in some way from atmospheric deposition in this desert environment? So they did a fairly simple test where they separated out calcite from these pedogenic horizons through leaching procedures and physical separation, and analyze the strontium in it. They also looked at the strontium in the soil exchange and in the soil minerals themselves and also in atmospheric deposition in that area. What they found is that the exchangeable and the carbonate strontium in the soils had a strontium 87-86 ratio, which was quite restricted and very much in the range of what was being deposited at that site by dust and rain. Whereas the soil silicate material, which if it weathered would be the other major contributor of strontium, was quite different in its isotopic composition. And if you do the mass balance calculation, you find that a very high fraction, greater than 98%, I think, or 95 to 98% of the strontium, and by inference the calcium, in these carbonate horizons was in fact derived ultimately from the atmosphere, from rain and dust, rather than from in-situ weathering of the soil minerals. And this was quite conclusive in this particular case, although it doesn't apply everywhere. It depends on the atmospheric flux. A similar type study was carried out in Hawaii, where you have different situations of obviously, the dust fluxes are very different over there, but you also they become important, particularly in some of these very old soils. And Andy Kurtz and Lou Derry and Oliver Chadwick looked at dust in a Hawaiian soil chronosequence. And what they found in general is that for soils that showed the greatest amount of weathering and removal of elements, including strontium, and in this case they also looked at neodymium isotopes, another radiogenic isotope system, those had the strongest contribution from a dust source. And that dust source in Hawaii is actually less from China, which has come, which has been blown off the desert region, and it goes over the Pacific and gets deposited on the Hawaiian Islands. And it's very isotopically distinct compared to the basaltic parent material. So it's a very good place to look at those two end members. And what they were able to do was create a mixing model, a two-isotope mixing model using neodymium strontium isotopes, and quantify the degree of mixing of Asian dust with Hawaiian basalt, and also they got some information about the extent of weathering of these soils prior and during deposition of dust, and the data ended up falling on a very nice mixing curve defined by this. So this was a very good example of how you can use it to quantify atmospheric input. Now, if we look at rainfall as a primary parameter, we did a study looking at a climate gradient in Hawaii on about 150,000-year-old soil with the same parent material, single lava flow or series of lava flows that came very close in time. And so very uniform parent, but it goes up a climate gradient from about 20 centimeters up to over 300 centimeters. So it goes from essentially desert to rainforest, same parent material, same amount of time. And in this study, we looked at the strontium isotope ratio of exchangeable or labile strontium, shown by the open circles, and then the residue after you extract the labile strontium, it's shown in black here. And we see a fairly nice correlation of the labile strontium having primarily a parent material signature in the dry part of the climate gradient. And at the wet part of the gradient, the isotopic signature is pretty much identical to that of precipitation, that is rainwater in the rainforest, which is derived from the Pacific Ocean and has a very uniform strontium isotope composition. So it looks like in these very wet parts of the profile, essentially all of the strontium, and by inference, then we can predict that all or most of the calcium in this ecosystem is introduced by rainwater. So it's essentially a hydroponic system. Whereas down on the drier sections, there's still a significant amount of parent material left. And basalt weathers fairly easily, so it's releasing its strontium, and that's still dominating the system. And then there's a changeover. And then there's also the Hawaiian dust component on the residue, which has some effect on top of that. But we think that the exchangeable effect is mostly related to the rainfall. And other workers have also shown that things like phosphorus in the very wet sites have to be contributed almost entirely by the dust deposition, because there's no original phosphorus left in these very wet sites. So we model these data to try to use them to quantify the amount of weathering in a very simple way, you know, sort of step function, where the percent of exchangeable strontium contributed by basalt weathering versus rainfall is high in the lower sections, and then it crosses over. And there's kind of a threshold right around 130 to 150 centimeters of rainfall. And we actually see that showing up in other chemical parameters. So it's an interesting finding that seems to go along with some other results that they're finding, for example, looking at beryllium isotopes. So this is just kind of a smattering of approaches that can be taken with radiogenic isotopes, and there are many others that have been done and can be done. But so far, for the most part, what we've seen is when people are looking at nutrient cycling and ecosystems, things like strontium and calcium does have radiogenic isotope as well that can be used, although it hasn't been applied very much, and that's an area that needs some work. They're good for the sort of soluble nutrient fluxes. For looking at weathering atmospheric deposition, these are useful, but then we can also apply other isotope systems to tell us other information. For example, neodymium isotopes, hafnium isotopes, and lead isotopes tend to be carried more by the dust component. They're not as soluble, and so they're telling us more about the mineral component as opposed to the soluble component entering the soil ecosystem. And things like lead, we can start to look at anthropogenic sources of lead in particular. There's been a lot of work done on that. And then there is some promise using certain radiogenic isotope systems for soil, the timing of soil formation and weathering. For example, there's been work done using uranium series disequilibrium and some very interesting work done to try to get the timing of when soils form and the degree to which they're replenished. And you can get a lot of interesting information with creative application of these systems. So really, when looking at a soil system, we're limited only by our imagination, what part of the soil system we want to look at in particular, what isotopes may be applicable to that, and what the variations are in our end members that allow us to quantify that. There are new isotope techniques being developed all the time, and with the advent of the multi-collector ICP-MS, that's also opening up new avenues for this kind of research. And I have to say, from my own applications, I came into these kinds of applications from a background of igneous petrology and actually working on meteorites, which was a traditional isotope person at the time that I went through this stuff. And I was seduced into the dark side or the light side by people like Oliver Chadwick and Bob Graham, and then later meeting people like Curtis, to apply these isotope systems to petagenesis. But really, I think the best advances come. I would never be able to do any of this on my own because I don't know enough about soils. But having soil scientists work together with isotope geochemists to brainstorm, I think we've been able to do some really interesting things. And there's a lot of good work that's going on out there. And it's through these collaborative teams that I think a lot of people have pointed out in this session are important, that we're going to get some of the best advances in applying radiogenic isotopes in this way. Thanks very much.
Very good. A question or two for Brian. Yes. So Brian, I have a question. Oh, Mike, did you have one?
Is there potential for using radiogenic isotopes to identify stratification of parent material? The identification of lithologic or petalogic discat unities, it seems to me, would be an application. And in fact, I think it seems like all of the examples you showed assume no lithologic or petalogic discat unities.
Right. No, that's right. And, you know, we started with the simple cases, for example, with, you know, basalt parent material from a single flow. That's as simple as it gets. But that's a very good point, because there are certain isotope systems, particularly isotopes of relatively immobile elements, that may be quite sensitive to original stratification, and they may preserve essentially a signature of the original stratification that's otherwise somewhat overprinted by the petagenic processes. So that's definitely an application. You know, generally people have stayed away from those situations, but that's a case, I think, where you could take advantage of the technique to actually try to identify that.
How does the comparison between the data, how does it compare with the strontium?
Well, that's a good question, and there hasn't been enough work on it. Most of the calcium isotopes people are doing now is they're actually looking at the stable isotope mass fractionation of calcium. Calcium is very difficult to measure, but that's something that if I don't do, somebody I think will do. It'd be very good to kind of test, you know, it behaves very similarly to strontium. It'd be a good way to test the extent to which strontium could be used as a proxy for calcium, because we're not that interested in strontium itself. It's a trace element, but calcium is a major component, and that's what we really want to track. So that's something that I think we need to work on.
Were we imposing strontium ratio in calcium carbonates and arsenicates in the magnetic soils? Is it a general observation that strontium 87 to 86 ratio is lower in calcium in carbonate minerals than zinc, or is it just a special case scale?
Yeah, it's the question is it general observation that the strontium isotope ratio in calcite would be lower than that of the silicate minerals. And it's really, I've found through my own experience that it's dangerous to predict ahead of time how it's going to turn out, because it really depends on the history of the silicate material and the source of the carbonate. If you're lucky, there's a good clear separation, and each is relatively well defined. Sometimes, though, the parent material could be lower than the carbonate. It just depends on that particular parent material. And if you're unlucky, each of them has such a range of values that you simply can't apply, strontium or other radiogenic isotopes usefully in that situation, and you have to move on. So I wouldn't say there's a general rule that it goes in that direction. Probably more often than not, but.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you.